Worldwide, cardiovascular disease affects the lives of hundreds of millions. Dedicated cardio nerds everywhere are working hard to fight this global epidemic. These are their stories.
Welcome, cardio nerds. This is Rick Ferraro, cardiology fellow at Johns Hopkins and co-chair for this prevention series. Today, we're excited to bring you our second episode covering GLP-1 agonists. I'm joined today by a phenomenal group, including Dr. Frank Azubu, cardiology fellow at UT Southwestern, passionate about prevention, imaging, and health equity. Frank, I've heard so many great things about you from Amit. It's great to have you on the show, and welcome to Cardio Nerds.
Rick, it's a pleasure to be here. Should be an awesome discussion, and as a major prevention enthusiast, I'm really looking forward to it. We have another trainee with us today. I'm happy to introduce Dr. Ty Sweeney. He's a chief resident at Johns Hopkins Bayview Medical Center and really just an amazing medical educator overall. Really excited to have you here, Ty.
Thanks, Frank. Really excited to be here and to dive into this topic. As our final introduction, it is my distinct honor to introduce our expert discussant, Dr. Darren McGuire. Dr. McGuire is professor of medicine in the Division of Cardiology at UT Southwestern Medical Center, where he focuses on the prevention of and risk modification for cardiovascular disease, particularly among patients with diabetes. He received his medical degree from Johns Hopkins University School of Medicine and completed his residency at UT Southwestern Medical Center. He then went on to complete his cardiology training at Duke. Dr. McGuire's research has led to publication of more than 100 peer-reviewed journal articles, and he serves as the deputy editor of Circulation, senior editor of Diabetes and Vascular Disease Research, and is an editor of the textbook Diabetes and Cardiovascular Disease. Dr. McGuire has received several teaching awards for his dedication to educating both his patients and his trainees, and we are thrilled that he is joining us today to discuss GLP-1 receptor agonists. Dr. McGuire, thank you for being here.
Thank you, Ty. It's a very nice introduction. I appreciate it. I look very much forward to this conversation as I've been deep into this field for now 25 years, and it's good to see this coming to fruition, and we're talking about it tonight.
And with that, let's jump right in with our first patient of the day here in the Cardio Nerds Prevention Clinic. Mr. Sammy Glutide is a 55-year-old male with a history of type 2 diabetes with a recent A1C of 7.5%, well-controlled hypertension, CKD stage 3, and class 2 obesity, seeing you today to discuss his ASCVD risk. His current medications include lisinopril, atorvastatin 40 milligrams daily, empagliflozin, and metformin 1,000 milligrams twice daily. He works as a tour guide for a local ballpark and denies any chest pain while walking around the stadium. He does report a strong family history of heart disease, though, and wants to take steps to prevent having a heart attack. He is a little leery of taking more medications, but will take them if they are going to benefit him. Dr. McGuire, do you think that Mr. Glutide would benefit from being on a GLP-1 receptor agonist? If so, how do you usually present the evidence to support that decision to your patients?
All right. First, I'd want to ask him which team he's working for at the stadium. That'd be of interest. But, you know, he falls into the intermediate zone because we know very clearly about the evidence for persons with type 2 diabetes and prevalent atherosclerotic cardiovascular disease. We have some data supporting the extension of that theory into people at high risk for cardiovascular disease. But what we've done in the guidelines is actually recommend for Mr. Glutide to have a form of quantitative risk estimation. And if his 10-year predicted cardiovascular risk, ASCVD risk exceeds 10%, he does fall into the category of a level 1A indication for consideration of a GLP-1 receptor agonist. And that's independent of the fact that he's already on empagliflozin, the other class of medications that have the same level of evidence and the same level of recommendation in the contemporary guidelines. The fact that he does have some degree of obesity amplifies the importance of this conversation.
Thanks so much, Dr. McGuire. I really appreciate that comment, and particularly noting that GLP-1s in the recent 2023 HAACC chronic coronary disease guidelines are a class 1 recommendation for patients with diabetes and CAD. Yeah, and really a high-value treatment option as highlighted in the guidelines. And so this is a really, really exciting group of medications for us.
Yeah, and I'll take you one step further. So I had the privilege of the last couple of years working behind the scenes on the task force of the ESC Diabetes Guidelines Committee. And we just published and presented, as you are probably aware, in August, a new ESC guideline on the treatment of persons with type 2 diabetes with cardiovascular disease. And we've taken one step farther than any prior recommendation or guideline with regards to these anti-hyperglycemic therapies that up until recently, it has been a choice effectively between a GLP-1 receptor agonist and or an SGLT2 inhibitor for persons with sufficient atherosclerotic cardiovascular disease risk with type 2 diabetes. We took the and or out of the equation, and we recommend both in parallel, just like we don't consider and or for four pillars of guideline-directed medical therapy for heart failure with reduced ejection fraction. We shouldn't parcel these two therapeutic options, one or the other. It should be both, and it should be both sequentially initiated, but both used simultaneously.
Thank you for that answer, Dr. McGuire. One question I did have relating to the case, does the patient A1C matter in terms of deciding to put him on a GLP-1?
Well, it's a great question. And, you know, these drugs initially came to market specifically for the treatment of hyperglycemia and A1C treatment. And then, as with all of the type 2 diabetes medications, we've evolved all of them into cardiovascular outcomes assessments. And so those that have successfully moved the needle to have superiority against placebo, we've now incorporated those into the guidelines. And those considerations are completely independent of hemoglobin A1C. They still are predicated on the presence of type 2 diabetes as a background, at least where we stand today. That's likely going to change as the obesity trials are yielding fruit for efficacy for persons without diabetes. So we're going to see evolution of the field. But for now, it's limited. The level 1A indication is limited to people with type 2 diabetes. And again, we're not treating hyperglycemia. We will get some beneficial effects on the glucose, but that's not the reason we're using them. So I look at the A1C when I'm going to start these medications, but not to try to find a A1C that's so low I won't start the medicine. But if the A1C is very low, and or if the patient's experiencing one or more episodes of hypoglycemia, you may think to back off of the background therapy. So if they're on, especially if they're on insulin or sulfonylurea, but at 7.5, I'm very comfortable adding this to whatever the patient's taking. In this case, Mr. Glucide's taking a metformin already. I wouldn't change that. I would simply add a GLP-1 receptor agonist to it. And again, as we mentioned, empagliflozin's already on board as well.
Thank you for that great answer. It sounds like a GLP-1 receptor agonist will be a great option for Mr. Glucide based on the data that we have at this time. Mr. Glucide is on board with starting a new medication and recalls seeing a commercial for an oral version, which he will prefer since he isn't the biggest fan of needles. Dr. McGuire, how would you counsel Mr. Glucide regarding the decision to use injectable versus oral semaglutide? Is there evidence to suggest that one is better than the other?
Yeah, it's a good question. It's a point of tension for a lot of patients as well as prescribers. There's a really unfounded fear of these injection therapies. And I will tell you, the needles are so small on these pens that are available for GLP-1 receptor agonist administration. It's not only does the injection not hurt very much, you simply cannot feel the needle enter the skin. This is the easiest thing to do. I would always choose to inject myself once weekly with the GLP-1 receptor agonist as opposed to having to take a tablet every day. So having said that, for semaglutide specifically, there is an oral formulation. It's the only formulation available. It's approved presently only for the treatment of hyperglycemia. I'm actually co-chairing the cardiovascular outcomes trial. So we expect the SOLE trial of oral semaglutide versus placebo for cardiovascular outcomes to finish around July 2024. So probably somewhere around first quarter of 2025, where we have data for cardiovascular efficacy and we can put it into the context of the other GLP-1 receptor agonists. I will say the formulation we're using, and that is approved for type 2 diabetes, the 14 milligrams a day of oral semaglutide, gives you a pharmacokinetic impulse of about 0.8 milligrams once weekly. And I'll remind you, the evidence-based dose of once weekly injectable is 1 milligram. So we're getting pretty close to pharmacokinetic equivalency between 1 milligram injected versus 14 milligrams tablet daily. If the person or the prescriber is completely opposed to injection, it is an option, but it's an option so far without evidence basis. And again, what I really like prescribers and patients in the clinic setting to take a placebo injectable pen and inject themselves to see exactly how easy this is to take an injectable GLP-1 receptor agonist. So we have that option. I will say there is a caveat with the oral semaglutide. It is only 0.8% bioavailable, which means 99.2% of the drug is actually excreted in the feces. And so this drug has a mechanism of delivery that requires attachment to the gastric mucosa. So it sticks to a specific place on the stomach, in the stomach wall, and only the point of contact of the tablet that's connected to the wall delivers drug. And so this drug, it's really important that oral, the tablet semaglutide, be taken on an empty stomach with no more than 4 ounces of water and nothing to eat or drink for 30 minutes after administration, which again is much more of an encumbrance for a single injection once a week. And I'll remind the listeners is the injection of small volume subcutaneous injections does not require skin cleansing. You simply have to bare the skin, inject it. The pins are automatically dialable and simply push a button. I can actually inject semaglutide or dulaglutide, the once weekly injections. I can inject those faster than I can take a tablet. So there's lots of unfounded concern about the injection component of these therapies.
Dr. McGuire, we just started this recording, but that was a tour de force. I need to go back and listen to that. And if given the opportunity, I would love to spend another couple hours with you, because that was really, I learned so much in just that introduction to what we're talking about here. So given all that evidence and all that teaching, our patient seems convinced of the efficacy of GLP-1 receptor agonist and is confident he can inject himself if it's once per week. Before he commits, he wants to know about side effects, if any, he might expect. And so Dr. McGuire, so right, we were hoping to ask, when recommending GLP-1 receptor agonist to patients, what anticipatory guidance do you give them about side effects?
Yeah, this anticipatory guidance when initiating these drugs is really important. It's a very important conversation to have. You need to level set expectations. Look, you're going to be nauseated. You're going to start this drug. We'll start it at the lowest dose. You will have some nausea, maybe even some vomiting. Most people don't have vomiting, and the nausea for most people is just a nuisance, but it goes away, and it goes away within 10, 15, 20 days usually. So maybe after one or two doses. So it gets better if you stick with the drug, and you need to really encourage people starting these medications to tolerate a little bit of nausea and GI side effects up front that will go away. They rarely come back when you're titrating therapy, and they almost are always completely gone by the time you get stable on the target dose of any of the evidence-based GLP-1 receptor agonist. But if you don't level set the expectation of the patient for the nausea, you're going to have a person who stops the medicine and won't want to retry it. But again, almost every person, at least in the clinical trials, very systematically coaching the persons as you start the medicine. There's no hurry to titrate. So if you have a patient at week 4 and it's time to titrate, but they're still having a little bit of nausea, wait for week 5 or week 6. There's no hurry. And if you titrate too fast, you're just going to lose the patient and lose the willingness for them to take the medicine. And you know, I will take this opportunity to encourage, if at all possible, and you have the resources, what we've done, I work with Franck, actually, in our fellowship. I run the cardiology fellowship, general cardiology clinics of the Parkland Health System. And we are fortunate to have a dedicated clinical pharmacist in our clinics. So when we want to start a GLP-1 receptor agonist for our cardiology patients, instead of writing a prescription and doing all the counseling ourselves, we simply send an epic message to our clinical pharmacist saying, please start a GLP-1 receptor agonist. And what she's able to do is, you know, review the person's financial support, figure out which one of the medications is most affordable, counsel the person on the injection teaching, counsel the person on the nausea and vomiting, virtually visit the patient every week as the initiation titration is going on, and actually titrate the medicine for us. And so they come back to us fully titrated on medication. This has been really well received by the patients and by the referring physicians and by the clinical pharmacists. Now the pharmacists have become very much a part of our patient care team. And so it's very much a team approach, and it has worked incredibly well in our clinic.
Thank you for that, Dr. McGuire. I think that I can speak for everyone in that. I want to underline what you said in saying that this is an excellent opportunity to involve other members of the care team, whether they be clinical pharmacists or medical assistants or nursing staff, to really kind of have a whole team behind the patient as you provide this, as you said, level setting of expectations, which, as we know, are so key to helping patients stay on board with therapy. So based on that, the decision is ultimately made to start Mr. Glutide on once weekly semaglutide with initial dosing at 0.25 milligrams and a plan to increase to 0.5 milligrams weekly after 1 month of treatment. After a second dose, he calls the clinic to report that he has been experiencing some nausea for a few days after each injection, but we're able to counsel him that this will likely go away after a couple doses. But I am curious, Dr. McGuire, have you had the experience of treating a patient with this, even with the appropriate guidance? You have patients that just seem to have really intractable nausea. And do you have a framework for when, if ever, you would consider potentially abandoning therapy in the face of these really severe symptoms should they arise?
It's a great question. And, you know, we've been doing this pretty routinely now for about 5 years in our clinic. And I honestly don't recall a single patient that couldn't tolerate based on GI side effects. Now, that's kind of cherry picked, I'm sure. I'm sure there are people I'm not aware of. And clearly in the clinical trials, there were patients who simply could not tolerate it. But it's in the single digits. It's probably around 5 to 7%. And in my experience, that even seems to be an overestimate, but probably I'm going to guess around 1 in 20 people will have such severe side effects, GI side effects early on, that they just are not willing to sustain or go through the titration. You know, those are patients that if you have accessibility, you might pivot then to the oral formulation if they can get it. Unfortunately, in our system, we don't have access to oral semaglutide, so it's injectable or nothing. So we really, really try hard. And if I would have a patient that just gave up, I would tend to give them a break and then maybe dosing every other week to start with, for example. I mean, I would make every effort to get them through, because what I have seen is everybody who makes that first step of titration, almost everybody sustains on the therapy, achieves the target dose, and really does not have very much in the way of GI side effects thereafter.
Kind of related to that, Dr. McGuire, I've always wondered, let's say the patient is at 0.25 and they don't want to go 2.5. Maybe they're worried about side effect. They've heard some stories. How hard do you push in terms of increasing the dose? Let's say the A1C is controlled, and so this is more for cardiovascular benefit. What is the relationship with the dose and the benefit they're going to get from a cardiovascular standpoint?
Yeah, that's a great unknown question, Frank. We haven't done dose response analyses based on how much of each drug do you really need to achieve the cardiovascular benefits. You know, I'll tell you, as we embarked on the SOUL trial with oral semaglutide, we know that we're only getting about 80% of the 1 milligram dose with the oral formulation. And what we wondered going in is, will we only get 80% of the efficacy? And only the trial will tell us. But I will tell you, we've seen recently from the SELECT trial, again, it's not a type 2 diabetes trial, but it is with semaglutide, a very high dose of semaglutide. If you've seen the data from the SELECT trial, I know that's a whole topic of a whole nother series, but what's really compelling about the results from the SELECT trial that showed the atherosclerotic cardiovascular disease benefit of high dose semaglutide in persons with obesity without diabetes, but with ASCVD, the event curves began to separate virtually immediately. And that's really important to your question, Frank, because if you dig into the details of the protocol, the people in the SELECT trial, as we do clinically, were started on 0.25 milligrams for 4 weeks and then titrated slowly over a 16 to 20 week period. So even during those first 20 weeks, we see separation of the curves as we're only on beginning doses of semaglutide. So it's possible that we may be getting the cardiovascular efficacy even as low as 0.25 a week. So I think those are really compelling data from SELECT that are indirect and not randomized, but tell us that probably some is better than none. And so for the patient you describe, if they can tolerate 0.25, but not 0.5, I'll be happy with them on 0.25 and I would continue it. I will try to push them to the target dose, which is really evidence-based medicine, but some is good. We don't know if more is better. And we really don't have trials that are assessing the dose dependency of the efficacy from a cardiovascular perspective. And taking one big step backwards, that's largely due to the fact that we really don't understand the mechanism behind the efficacy of GLP-1 receptor agonism on ASCVD. And it may be that whatever the mechanism is, let's say, for example, which is the leading hypothesis, that it's suppression of inflammation, we get a pretty robust suppression of inflammation at the 0.25 milligram dose. And so, again, I would try to reproduce the doses that are proven effective and safe in the clinical trials. But if you can't get to that titration, I will take whatever else I can get.
Thank you so much for that answer. Going back to the case, and I think you've kind of spoken a little bit about this already, but we know that misoglutide is also taking empagliflozin, which is an SGLT2 inhibitor with proven cardiovascular benefit, especially in patients with heart failure. What does the literature say regarding the combination of SGLT2 inhibitor with GLP-1 receptor agonist? And I think a second question that I will have is, in those patients with diabetes and heart failure, if cough is an issue, how would you approach that situation?
Yeah, so very different questions. The first question has been the topic of conversation for the last 10 years. is one class is good. Certain members of one class have proven efficacy. Certain members of another class have certain efficacy. Do we need to do combination trials to see if they're additive? And I think that makes sense when you're considering both of these drugs as glucose lowering medications. But the reality is these two drugs are completely different in their mechanism of action. And they're inevitably completely different in their cardiovascular efficacy or the mechanisms behind their efficacy. So we have never in cardiology required proof of combination before we applied a new therapy. So let's just put this in the context of the guideline-directed medical therapies for heart failure with reduced ejection fraction. We never paused to add one drug to another before we had combination therapy trials. It would be silly to say beta blocker and or an MRA and or a RAS inhibitor and or an SGLT2 inhibitor. We consider them in parallel. We have pretty good confidence that each of them are impacting different mechanistic axes, and they're likely, they might not be completely additive, but we're pretty confident they'll be complementary. This hunger for a combination trial or proof of efficacy in combination, I think it falls on deaf ears, or you know, and that's why we were very aggressive in the ESC guideline. This was one of my major contributions to the guideline, is we had to take out the and or. They're mutually exclusive. They're both beneficial. They may not be completely additive, but they will be complementary. And I'm very confident in that. And to add the best available evidence to that commentary, we have now done sub-analyses of background therapy of one class in the context of a randomized trial of the other. So let's say we're testing an SGLT2 inhibitor versus placebo. Let's do a stratified analysis by patients prescribed GLP-1 receptor agonist versus placebo. Now, this is confounding by indication and prescription and indication for the therapy. This is observational analyses. And even if you do all the state-of-the-art propensity adjustments, you still don't achieve randomized exposure to GLP-1 receptor agonist. But every time we've done this for the SGLT2 inhibitor trials, if anything, the people treated background with GLP-1 receptor agonist had the same, if not greater, point estimate of efficacy. And the same is true in the GLP-1 receptor agonist trials, analyzing by exposure to SGLT2 inhibitor. We are really excited. Our prioritized first sub-analysis from the SOUL trial will be analyses of oral semaglutide with or without background SGLT2 inhibitor. We have 27% of persons entering that trial, 10,000 patient trial, 27% enter on SGLT2 inhibitor. We expect about 15% will begin SGLT2 inhibitor during the trial. So we'll have about 40% of the cohort on background SGLT2 inhibitor. The biggest exposure that we have to evaluate observationally the efficacy of oral semaglutide with or without background SGLT2 inhibitor. So what we've seen from every analysis suggests that they're at least complementary and certainly safe to use together.
Well, I can say we will definitely at the Cardio Nerds be waiting for that subgroup analysis to come out. And I'm sure that we'll be diving straight into those results too to inform our future practice as well. Building off of that, Dr. McGuire, let's just say that our patient, Mr. Glutide's diabetes was under better control. We heard in the question stem that his A1C was about 7.5%. And then from a hyperglycemia standpoint, obviously he would benefit from the action of the GLP-1 receptor agonist. But let's say hypothetically his A1C were under better control, perhaps in the mid-6 range, and he didn't necessarily need any additional glucose lowering therapy. You had briefly mentioned it earlier in the recording, but how should we be thinking about starting GLP-1 receptor agonists in patients who may not necessarily need additional diabetes therapy specifically, knowing the data that we have on board?
Yeah, very timely question. You know, over the last decade, as these cardiovascular outcomes data have emerged, there's been a contention between the cardiologist and the endocrinologist about the importance of metformin first. And so if this person who's taking metformin, I think it was either 1 gram a day or 1 gram BID, if he's taking metformin already and he's that well controlled from a glucose perspective, my proposition would be to stop the metformin and get them on both an SGLT2 inhibitor and a GLP-1 receptor agonist. All of the trials that we've done sub-analysis, there's no requisite for background metformin for the efficacy of these medications. And we very explicitly in the ESC guideline completely separated the decision to prescribe these drugs from whether or not metformin is on background. And very impressively, for the last 2 years since the standards of care, so the American Diabetes Association updates the standards of care for the treatment of type 2 diabetes every year. It usually comes out online in December and published in February. And since 2022, the ADA has acknowledged completely do not consider whether or not metformin is on background. We need to use these two classes of medications, members of the classes with evidence basis, independent of metformin. And if you can get to therapeutic target with just an SGLT2 inhibitor and a GLP-1 receptor agonist, there's no need to add metformin to it. Now, I don't have a problem if someone wants to do that. There's almost no risk whatsoever with any one of these therapies or their combination for hypoglycemia. You know, we're using both SGLT2 inhibitors and GLP-1 receptor agonists in people without diabetes. For the SGLT2 inhibitors, persons with heart failure with or without diabetes, for obesity, the GLP-1 receptor agonist. So we are very comfortable using these drugs in people with normal hemoglobin A1C, much less well-controlled diabetes level hemoglobin A1C. But if you don't need metformin, you don't need metformin. The data for cardiovascular risk mitigation with metformin is pretty much neutral. You know, we gave it a level 2A indication in the ESC guideline. And instead of a 2B indication, which I thought it only deserved, the 2A is driven only by the clinical consensus, which for the first time I found out in writing of guidelines, you can elevate a level of recommendation based on broad clinical consensus, which seems a little bit silly to me. But the bottom line is there's no risk of hypoglycemia. There's no A1C that's too low to start these drugs. And I'll go back to what I said earlier, hinted at. The caveat there is if a person is on insulin or if they're on a sulfonylurea, that's the only context in which either or both of these drug classes will increase risk for hypoglycemia. We tend to completely stop the sulfonylureas, but we've been doing that long before the GLP-1 receptor agonist and SGLT2 inhibitor data. But if a person's on insulin, we did this just this afternoon in clinic. Person was on 70-30 insulin. We stopped the short-acting insulin. We reduced the net daily dose by 40% because the A1C was 6.9. And we were starting semaglutide. So as cardiologists, this is the one situation where I will muddle with the background glucose lowering therapies. And when we do this, we send an epic message to the person that's running the glucose control management of the person. We make them very clear that we're not going to get into your business managing glucose from our clinic, but we do want to make sure you understand it's imperative the person's on these medications. And for safety purposes, we've modified your background therapy a little bit and we'll defer to you to see if that needs further adjustment.
Dr. Guire, that's so incredibly helpful. And particularly your point on hypoglycemia, for so many clinicians really across medicine, it's a real fear. Providing the data to mitigate some of those concerns is a huge help to our listeners, I'm sure. You know, I'd love to hear as well, we've talked about GLP-1s, we've talked about SGLT2s. A couple follow-ups here. Could you tell us about when you first learned about some of the exciting data around GLP-1s and their effect on cardiovascular outcomes? And if you want to speak on the SELECT trial there too, because this is, you know, so recent for us, we'd love to hear that. And then as kind of a follow-up to that, what additional studies do you see on the horizon? I know you had mentioned one that you're involved in currently, but would love to hear your thoughts.
Yeah, so much to talk about. But first, I realized I never answered Frank's second question about diabetes and heart failure and cost. The question is, even beyond cost, with a person with type 2 diabetes in heart failure, whether it's preserved or reduced ejection fraction, we now know that SGLT2 inhibitors are indicated for all those patients. The GLP-1 receptor agonists are not directly indicated for persons with heart failure, but we're getting more and more confident that they're at least safe in that population and in the setting of obesity, probably incrementally beneficial. So if a person has heart failure, I would probably put GLP-1 receptor agonist as a thing to consider later and focus primarily on the SGLT2 inhibitor in the context of the other evidence-based therapies for the condition. And so for HFpEF with the MRAs and for reduced ejection fraction with the other three pillars of therapy. We are tending for people with heart failure to start the SGLT2 inhibitors as a first line drug if the patient has access and it's affordable. In our, you know, again, I'm privileged to work in the Parkland Health System where we have unrestricted access to empagliflozin. And so we are prescribing this routinely as a first line therapy among the other pillars. We may also be prescribing one or more of each of the others, but because it has such little hemodynamic embarrassment and we don't have to monitor anything, there's very little downside to starting it first. And if you go back to look at the ASCVD trials of SGLT2 inhibitors, the curves for heart failure incidents begin to diverge almost immediately after initiation. So if you wait for 1 month or 3 months, you've lost 3 months of efficacy. So it's the most acutely impactful therapy we have for heart failure. Getting to the heart failure issue with GLP-1 receptor agonists, in persons with heart failure with preserved ejection fraction, I've been very comfortable using them, and the SELECT trial supports that substantially, that a lot of the heart failure in the STEP-HFpEF trial, particularly with semaglutide, incrementally beneficial in persons with obesity and HFpEF. There were two randomized trials of liraglutide, once daily injectable GLP-1 receptor agonist in persons with very advanced reduced ejection fraction heart failure, the LIVE and the FIGHT trials. Both of those had a signal of adversity, about a 30% point estimate of adverse effects on heart failure hospitalization, cardiovascular death. It was similar between the two groups. So this gave us a flag of caution about the potential safety of GLP-1 receptor agonist in reduced ejection fraction heart failure, especially advanced. When we publish in Circulation a review article suggesting that we can't contraindicate it at this point, but we need to do it if we're going to do it with caution. I will tell you, in the SELECT trial, again, a patient population without diabetes, but with obesity, and 25% roughly had heart failure at study entry. About one third of those had heart failure with reduced ejection fraction. That's a 17,000 patient trial. So a small subset proportionally at study entry, still a pretty good exposure. And so I'll be very interested to see what the persons in SELECT with reduced ejection fraction heart failure, how high dose semaglutide behaved for outcomes. So now, Rick, getting back to your question about kind of when did we first start seeing these signals of superiority, and I will take you back to 2008 when the FDA and the European Medicines Agency began requiring cardiovascular outcomes data for novel antihyperglycemic therapies. And so I had been involved, along with Rob Califf, who's my mentor and now the FDA commissioner. We had had a series of four meetings with the FDA, nudging them to require cardiovascular outcomes evidence. Finally, rosiglitazone, the signal for myocardial infarction, completely pushed the FDA to make a decision. And so since 2008, we've been doing these trials. Because I was positioned with Rob Califf's mentorship, I was involved in almost all of the early trials, and probably 80% of the trials since 2008 I've had some role in. And I'll remind you, we had a lot of disappointing results early on with the DPP-4 inhibitors. We had a series of four trials that proved safety, but not incremental efficacy. And you may or may not recall the very first GLP-1 receptor agonist trial, the ELIXA trial with eliximetide, was completely neutral. So we had our very first signal of no incremental efficacy, but as you know, ever since. So beginning in 2016 at the ADA, we had the LEADER trial presented with liraglutide, a once daily injectable GLP-1 receptor agonist versus placebo. The very first GLP-1 receptor agonist trial with statistical superiority for cardiovascular outcomes. And so from that time, we've now had seven large-scale outcomes trials, three of which have led to product-labeled indications in the U.S. for efficacy. So to consider the GLP-1 receptor agonist in people with type 2 diabetes, with or at high risk for ASCVD, independent of glucose control, consider a GLP-1 receptor agonist. And that includes once daily injectable liraglutide, also known as Victoza, once weekly injectable semaglutide, also known as Ozempic, and then once weekly dulaglutide, also known as Trulicity. All three of these have product labeled indications, diabetes and ASCVD. So, you know, since 2016, and we're 7 years into this, so, you know, the data are robust, they're consistent. They're product labeled. Third-party payers are now covering them almost completely. So this is really a cardiologist issue. These are no longer endocrinology or primary care drugs. We need to be prescribing them ourselves, just like we did back in the 90s as we took over the statin prescriptions from the endocrinology domain. We don't need to take over the prescription, but we certainly need to partner with all the other care providers and prescribe these for our patients with type 2 diabetes who have indications.
I know we're coming towards the end, Mr. McGuire, and so I had one more question for you, and this does have to do with the SELECT trial. And my question is regarding cost, but more of on a societal level. I think it was estimated that it would cost about $1.1 million to prevent a heart attack over 3 years. We do know there is benefit. And my question for you was, do you feel that this is a medication that an organization like Medicare should just go ahead and cover despite the cost burden? Or how would you approach that if you were in charge?
Yeah, these are incredibly difficult conversations that we're having in real time, is how can we possibly apply the evidence that has been generated? I will tell you, you and I both, Frank, are at UT Southwestern Medical Center in Dallas. We are part of 16 campuses within the UT system, 10 undergraduate and 6 medical campuses. We are all covered under one single umbrella third-party payer. Everyone is covered by Blue Cross Blue Shield. And about 3 months ago, Blue Cross Blue Shield, covering UT's system, made a decision that they will not cover any part of any obesity drug. They just simply can't afford it. Well, that was before the SELECT trial evidence, but now we have evidence of efficacy. How can the drug companies and the third-party payers and the governmental entities, is this a time where we begin to negotiate as a country costs of medications? The costs as they are retail are grossed up substantially and then rebated over and over again. And so the actual out-of-pocket payment of the person is extremely variable, and the cost to society can't be calculated because we can't calculate on average when you take into account all the rebates and coverages. And it is unbelievably complicated. Maybe you should have an economist or someone involved in these cost decisions, because I am not part of it, and it just confuses me completely. What I can tell you is we simply can't afford, when it's estimated by 2035, 50% of the global adult population will be overweight or obese, having an indication for eligibility for the SELECT trial. We can't treat 50% of the globe, the drug that is costing in the $1,000 a month range, or for the weight loss drugs, even higher, sometimes up to $3,000 per month. So we're going to have to figure this out, and we can't wait till they go generic. We've got a public health crisis on our hands. We've got an effective therapy that's well tolerated and materially moves a lot of important clinical outcomes for persons with obesity. And it's not just they live longer and feel better, but all of the societal benefits of productivity at work and other issues, obstructive sleep apnea, atrial fibrillation, orthopedic issues, psychological issues. There are so many things that are involved in the treatment of obesity that we haven't seen gleaned yet from the SELECT trial. But now that we've proven outcomes from a cardiovascular perspective, we now have a basis for evidence-based outcomes intervention that we can build on top of all the other ancillary morbidities of these patients.
Thank you so much for that extensive answer, Dr. McGuire. Just like in the CCU, it's always a pleasure to kind of just hear your thoughts about all the way you approach this as you think about the issues. I'm so grateful to have learned a lot during this conversation. For the cardio nerds listening, what final takeaways on the data and guidelines for GLP-1 would you recommend?
Yeah, I would say, and I assume most of the listeners are cardiologists or involved in cardiology care, and I would just say we have to embrace these medications, both the SGLT2 inhibitors and GLP-1 receptor agonists, as part, just like statins, for persons with indication, these are part of our toolbox. And we can't defer prescription of these drugs to other providers for the primary care or endocrinologists. These are our medications. We need to lead the way and prescribe them for people who have access to them. Our approach in our cardiology clinic is we start for people most of the time have similar indications. We will start the SGLT2 inhibitor first. It's a once daily tablet, very little to monitor, a little bit of education about holding on days where you're not taking a normal amount of PO intake, redoubling urinary hygiene, but pretty simple to start. And then we defer the initiation of the GLP-1 receptor agonist until they're stable. And we take great care with our clinical pharmacists, as I mentioned. Let's hold the hands of the patients. Let's understand that they're going to have some nausea and GI side effects, and work them through it so we can get people on these medications that individually and in combination will increment. And I will remind you, we've proven efficacy on top of the very best evidence-based therapy of the day. And so this is incremental to everything else that we're doing.
Dr. McGuire, that was excellent. And, you know, we're so grateful for you joining us today and sharing expertise on these medications. I think that what makes me so excited about training during a time where these medications are becoming more prevalent and guideline recommended is, as we touched on multiple times during this conversation, the opportunity to involve other members of the team, like clinical pharmacists, et cetera, and also the blurring of the lines between specialties, where we can reach across, not across the aisle to suggest that there's any adversarial component here, but to be able to have discussions with our colleagues about these medications that span multiple circles in the Venn diagram, if you will. So that just gets me really excited about practicing cardiology, using these medications, and seeing what new medications are on the horizon. Before we wrap up, we at Cardio Nerds always love to ask this question, so I'll ask it to you now. What makes your heart flutter about cardiovascular disease prevention?
Well, for me, for 25 years, it's been pretty much in the domain of type 2 diabetes. I've been so pleased and just gracious that we've had such advance in the field of type 2 diabetes. When I entered this field, the only therapies that we had approved in the United States was insulin and sulfonylureas. That was 1993. And we have more therapeutic classes available for the treatment of hyperglycemia and type 2 diabetes than we have for the treatment of hypertension. And so we have a lot of options, and we've gone to the next level. We've actually, because we have so many options, we have the luxury of time to test, are the new drugs better than placebo? Are the new drugs better than the old drugs? And we've really moved the needle on the care of these patients and, importantly, their outcomes. And so we've made a lot of progress. We still have a lot of work to do. We're studying oral semaglutide, tirzepatide, the dual GLP-1 receptor GIP agonist that causes so much weight loss and is so effective at glucose control. I'm on the executive committee of the SURPASS CVOT, so we're studying cardiovascular outcomes there. And we have an extraordinary array. I think we have something around 60 different compounds in phase 2A or above for the treatment of obesity. And so we're going to be studying all kinds of different interventions on obesity with regards to their success, not just for weight loss, but for their cardiovascular safety and efficacy. So I'm pivoting pretty quickly into the obesity space as the type 2 diabetes space is kind of slowing down. But we have so much cardiometabolic future. If I were to give advice to folks like you, Ty, dive in. This is the obesity realm. And I'll just add a plug for the renal, the kidney, cardiac axis as well. So if I were going to embark and I want to do clinical outcomes trials, I would go with obesity or cardio-kidney evaluations going forward.
Yeah, Dr. McGuire, this has been one of the more enlightening conversations I've had in a really long time, probably across cardiology. There's just a huge amount that I've learned tonight and really excited to share with our listeners as well. I really can't thank you enough.
Well, thanks. It's been great. You know, as you can tell, I'm pretty passionate about this field. I love to teach. I love to do evidence-based evidence generation and application. And so I love the fact that you all are interested in this field and we're spreading the word. And it's a very dynamic process, but a very promising time.
Thank you so much, Dr. McGuire.
All right. Thank you.
Thank you so much for tuning in to this Cardio Nerds episode. The audio editing for this episode was performed by me, Diane Maskett. I'm an intern in the Cardio Nerds Academy House Thomas and fourth-year medical student at Rowan Virtua School of Osteopathic Medicine in New Jersey. Check out the episode page for show notes and references. If you found this episode or the show informative, please consider subscribing to Cardio Nerds on your favorite podcast platform and leaving us a review. It really helps us spread the word and further our goal to democratize cardiovascular education. Finally, this podcast is not meant to be used for medical advice. The views expressed on our show and site do not reflect the opinions or policies of our employers. All Cardio Nerds content is planned, produced, and reviewed solely by Cardio Nerds. Stay tuned for more engaging conversations and explorations in our new and exciting upcoming episodes.
And team, one last thing. This episode is produced in collaboration with the American Society of Preventive Cardiology, with independent medical education grant support from Novo Nordisk.
And now, my friends, it's time to make like an S2 and split.